that we would measure in correlation functions, basically the CMB. All right, so first let me motivate a little bit with these standard cosmological puzzles. So on the largest scales, when we go out and observe the universe, we see that it's very flat, very homogeneous, and very isotropic. And you can see this is an old plot from WMAP, but we lie very close to being on this flat universe line. And this is true actually even in apparently causally disconnected regions. So there has to be some mechanism which homogenizes the universe on super horizon scales. And then on top of this extreme homogeneity, we actually observe a spectrum of perturbations which are very small, so they're about microkelvin scale in temperature. And they imply that the initial conditions which seeded these perturbations are very nearly scale invariant and Gaussian. And another way of saying this is that if you believe that some quantum field is responsible for these perturbations in the early universe, it has to be very weakly coupled or very close to being a Gaussian free field. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more about these temperature and isotropies. So the idea is that some field initially seeded these perturbations on superhorizon scales, and then during a phase of radiation domination, they come back inside the horizon, and they imprint, they undergo some coherent oscillations during radiation domination with this plasma, and then they imprint on the surface of left scattering, and we see them. And by looking at the cosmic microwave background, we can decompose these temperature fluctuations into spherical harmonics, and then measurement of these coefficients can tell us something about the primordial perturbations that were the initial conditions for these oscillations. Okay, so what can we learn from the CMB about these primordial and inhomogeneities? So it turns out that the CLs are related to the primordial power spectrum through convolution with some transfer function. And so by measuring this left-hand side, we can infer something about the right-hand side, assuming that we know something about the plasma physics that was going on in the early universe, which we think we understand pretty well. Okay. So the CMB measurements indicate that primordial perturbations are very close to being adiabatic. And what this means is that while the total energy density can vary, the relative energy densities of different components does not very much. So it tells you that there's sort of, so if you remember, energy density is linked to curvature. And so for this reason, sometimes these adiabatic perturbations are also called curvature perturbations. Okay. These perturbations are also very nearly scale invariant. So if we posit some power law form for P zeta, like this, k to the 2 ns minus 1, we find that ns has to be very close to 1. And what this tells you is that the two-point function of this is constant per logarithmic interval, basically. Okay, yeah, no, I don't think so either, sorry. It just tells you that you'll just read anything that's on your slide, right? I'm sorry, no, there shouldn't be a 2 there. Okay, and further we know that the perturbations were seeded by a field which is very close to being Gaussian. So for an exact Gaussian field, the three-point function vanishes. So I can parameterize the three-point function by some dimensionless parameter and then a function which depends on the momenta. And basically, measurements of the CMB constrain this FNL parameter to be very small. So for the latest Planck results, it's all consistent with zero for the various shapes. Okay. So now I've told you something about the perturbations. Let's go back and talk about the background homogeneity and isotropy. So let me tell you first why this is a problem, why you would expect not to find a universe that is homogeneous and isotropic, right? So here I've written the Friedmann equation with various types of matter. So there's matter, radiation, and isotropy here. And then this is just the Friedmann equation for a general equation of state. Okay, so if we started out in an expanding universe, naively, you would expect this curvature term here to dominate because it redshifts the most slowly with scale factor, right? So you would expect that if you went out and measured the universe, you would expect to see a largely curved universe with this term dominating. But actually, we find that this term is completely negligible, right? And so how can you make this term lose compared to everything else? So the easiest way to do it is to just introduce a component with W less than minus a third. And of course, W less than minus a third leads to accelerated expansion or inflation. But one thing I want to emphasize is that there's actually a different way to do this. So if the universe is contracting initially, now this term is the most dangerous because it blue shifts the fastest. It has the highest power of 1 over A. So how can you beat this term and drive the universe to be smooth and homogeneous? Well, all you have to do is have some fluid with an equation of state W bigger than 1. And if you do this, you find that this actually leads to a very slowly contracting universe. So it's a fluid with a very stiff equation of state. Okay, so this sort of second alternative is the one which is utilized by Ekpyrosis. And it'll be the one that we will see will be useful in this conformal scenario that I'll tell you about in a little bit. Okay, and one important thing which is true for almost all alternatives to inflation is that in scenarios where W is very large, it has this very stiff equation of state, the background evolves very, very slowly, and there's almost no production of gravitational waves. So if, roughly speaking, measurement of gravitational waves would be like a true smoking gun signal that inflation surely took place. Okay, so let me first tell you a little bit about inflation and how it solves these problems. So inflation explains the homogeneity and isotropy that we see by positing a phase of de Sitter or quasi-de Sitter expansion. So this is the line element for de Sitter, written in flat coordinates. And we imagine that this is driven by a component with nearly constant energy density, and a concrete example of this is just a scalar field rolling down a very nearly flat potential. And here you can compute with the equation of state parameters, and it's very close to being minus one. And if you remember, I told you before, a phase with W less than minus a third will naturally solve these horizon homogeneity and flatness problems. Okay, and then in inflation, the picture is that quantum fluctuations of this inflaton field as it rolls down the potential are the things that get imprinted on the temperature and isotropies in the late universe, or early universe, sorry. Okay, so I've told you that de Sitter space is very powerful in solving these background cosmological problems. So let's investigate what the symmetries of de Sitter are a little bit. And we'll be able to see that this nearly scale invariant spectrum of perturbations really comes from the de Sitter symmetries at play. Okay, so de Sitter space is a maximally symmetric space. So it has 10 Killing vectors. Six of them are obvious. So this is de Sitter in the flat slicing. I took this nice conformal diagram from these guys. So this is a spatial slice in red. So it has the three translations and three rotations of a spatial slice. And then it also has four more slightly more exotic symmetries. So it has a dilation symmetry, and it has these three symmetries which mix space and time. And they sort of, I'm going to call them conformal transformations for reasons which will become obvious in a minute. And together, these form the isometry algebra of de Sitter, which is just SO41. Okay, so the question I want to ask and answer is, how do these symmetries act on fields that we put on de Sitter? And we'll see that the symmetries naturally lead to this observed scale invariant spectrum for fields living on de Sitter. This is a well-known thing. Okay, yeah, so let's just look at a massive scalar field on de Sitter. So I'm just going to minimally couple it to the de Sitter metric, and I'm going to assume that the de Sitter metric is non-dynamical for now. So this is the equation of motion, and if I look at just the long wavelength solution, I find that phi just grows like a power law in conformal time. And the power is set basically by the mass, so the only free parameter here is the mass of the field. And in the long wavelength limit, I can trade time derivatives for basically deltas here, because I know what the time dependence is. And then I can infer what the isometries look like acting on fields. Yeah, sorry, this should be like delta D acting on the field here. Sorry about that. So by trading eta d eta for delta, you can figure out how the isometries act on the future boundary of de Sitter on the fields. And they act in this way. And this is precisely the way that conformal transformations act on R3. Okay, and this is just a well-known fact. This is just the statement that the isometry algebra of de Sitter is identical to the conformal algebra of a three spatial slice. Okay. So you can use these symmetries to say something about correlation functions for spectator fields and inflation without doing any work. So you can sort of just co-opt some CFT technology. Okay, so what we're interested in cosmology are late time correlation functions, and we know that the de Sitter symmetries act like conformal symmetries at late times. So from that, we can infer what the form of the late time correlation functions have to be. Okay, sorry, this should be an eta here too. Okay, so the two-point function just from symmetry has to, the only dimensionful thing is x minus x prime, and you know that both sides have to have weight minus 2 delta, this is the only thing you can write down. And remember that delta is basically given by the mass of the field. So I can say the same thing in Fourier space. I can ask, how does the delta operator act on the two-point function? And it acts in this way. And so if you want a dilation invariant correlation function, this has to be zero. So it implies that the two-point function scales in this way with k. Yes?
So for the scaling relation,
yes.
You know that there's no dimension of one that depends on the ratio of x to x prime because
Yeah, well, I think it comes from translation invariant soup. You know that the theory is also translationally invariant, so the only thing that the correlation function can depend on is x minus x prime. So you're not allowed to do things like divide x by x prime. Does that make sense? Okay. So the point I want to make is that using just dilation symmetry, so I've also implicitly used conformal symmetry here, but just looking at the dilation symmetry, you can figure out that the two-point function has to scale in this way with delta. And if delta is very small, you can see that this scales exactly in the scale invariant way. So the two-point function will go like 1 over k cubed. Yes? Yeah, I'm looking at equal time correlators. So I feel like I'm looking at correlation functions on strictly on the future boundary of the sitter. Okay, so this, roughly speaking, is how multi-field inflation works. So in multi-field inflation, you imagine that you have some field which is driving a de Sitter background, and then you have some light field that doesn't appreciably back react on the geometry. And basically, just from symmetry considerations, as I've shown you, you can see that it will acquire a scale invariant spectrum. And then the picture is that this gets imprinted onto the CMB in some way. But I'll remain agnostic about how precisely this happens. OK, so there are also some constraints on higher point correlation functions. So for example, just from these conformal symmetries, you can see that the three-point function shape is entirely fixed. But of course, the normalization is a free parameter. OK, so what I've told you is true for spectator fields during inflation, but not about the inflaton itself, which drives inflation. So the story is a little bit different, but the near-scale invariance of the inflaton still basically has its root in dilation invariance, which I'll show you. OK, so let me give you a one-slide recap of how slow roll inflation works very quickly. So the idea is that we have a scalar field which rolls down a nearly flat potential. So here I've just minimally coupled a scalar field to Einstein gravity. And here's maybe a cartoon of what the potential looks like. So what we imagine is that if the potential satisfies these slow roll conditions, then the background is some quasi-de Sitter space. OK. So here, when the field rolls down the potential, at some point it will start rolling too fast and it will break these slow roll approximations. And at that point, we imagine that inflation ends and reheating occurs. OK, so in order to analyze fluctuations of this field, we have to fix a gauge. So typically what people do is they choose this so-called zeta gauge or co-moving gauge, where the level sets, or the slicing of the sitter, if you like, are just slices of constant phi. So phi is unperturbed. And you shuffle all the fluctuations into the metric. This is the analog of a unitary gauge in the standard model. OK, so then you can, by plugging this back into the action, infer a quadratic action for this scalar perturbation. It's basically just given by this. So you have to remember epsilon is nearly constant during inflation. So this just looks more or less like a scalar field living on the sitter. Because during inflation, alpha goes like 1 over eta squared. Sorry, alpha goes like 1 over eta. Alpha squared goes like 1 over eta squared. OK, so you can compute the power spectrum seen by zeta. And you find that it is very close to being scale invariant. And it fails to be scale invariant precisely by the dilation operator acting on the two-point function, is this ns minus 1 factor. And this deviation from scale invariance is basically given by, from the deviation from de Sitter space. OK. OK, so now I want to see what we can say about inflation from purely symmetry considerations again. OK, so this is sort of the viewpoint which is taken in the effective field theory of inflation. So a very low rent observation about inflation is that it ends at some point. So we're not still inflating. So this tells you that there has to be something which tells inflation when to end, right? And furthermore, it tells you that the space-time cannot be exact visitor. Okay. So there has to be some clock telling inflation when to end, and the inflaton is precisely this clock. And this gives you a preferred foliation of your de Sitter space. So exactly as we did in slow roll inflation, you take these slices of constant inflaton. This gives you a preferred foliation, and it gives you some flat spatial slicing of de Sitter. Okay, so if you want to think of this from some global symmetry breaking perspective, you know that the isometries of de Sitter, sorry, this should be SO41. The isometries of de Sitter are just the de Sitter algebra, SO41. And you want to ask what are the symmetries that it is broken to. So it's broken to the symmetries of a spatial slice, which are three rotations and three translations. And so if you remember before, I told you that de Sitter space has 10 isometries. So what are the broken ones? The broken ones are a dilation and then these three special conformal transformations that I told you about.
I don't understand. Yeah.
Sorry, what?
Your right-hand side is breaking to SO3.1.
No, I'm breaking just a spatial slice.
First class, okay.
Yeah. The picture is I take the Sitter space and I slice it by flat spatial slices, and I just ask, what are the symmetries of these flat spatial slices? And then the point is the Goldstone mode associated to this are precisely fluctuations of this spatial slice, which is precisely zeta. So from a global symmetry breaking perspective, zeta is really the Goldstone of breaking this de Sitter symmetry in this way that I've described. Okay, so notice that we've broken four symmetries, but there's only one Goldstone. And this is sort of something that happens very commonly when you break space-time symmetries. There's some redundancy in the Goldstone description where you actually need fewer fields to describe the theory than you would think naively.
Can I think of that as there's some combination which preserves
No, strictly speaking, no. It's more like, so the intuition that I always have is if you take like just a brain, putting it in space, it will break rotations and translations and boosts, obviously, transverse to the brain. But you can cook up something that looks like a rotation by just doing a spatially varying translation. So this tells you that in some sense, allowing yourself, so a Goldstone mode is just a spatially varying symmetry transformation. So the fact that you can make a rotation look like, or you can make a spatially varying translation look like a homogeneous rotation tells you that there's some redundancy in allowing yourself to have both a spatially varying translation and a spatially varying rotation, right? So you can trade one for the other. That's sort of the intuition, right? And sort of a similar thing is happening here. You don't need to have both dilation and special conformal Goldstone. Mm-hmm. I see, but there are additional Ward identities. So here I'm breaking four symmetries. I still have four Ward identities. It has to do with the current. Okay. What's that? Yeah. Okay, yeah, so you say there's only one current to produce a Goldstone field. Okay. Okay, yeah, so precisely due to these non-linearly realized or broken symmetries, there will be Ward identities in the theory. And they'll constrain correlation functions with different numbers of fields. So in theories with linearly realized symmetries, typically the Ward identities take the form some operator acting on a correlator has to annihilate it. But in theories with spontaneously broken symmetries, typically the Ward identities take the form that if you have an n plus one point function with a soft external leg, it's related to a lower point function. And the intuition for this is really just that computing a correlation function in the background of a long mode is like computing it in a slightly transformed vacuum. Okay. So I told you what the symmetry breaking pattern is, but I haven't told you how these symmetries act on the inflaton. So you can think of it this way. If you go through this gauge fixing procedure that we did before, this zeta gauge doesn't actually completely fix all the gauge freedom in the theory. There are these residual large gauge transformations which preserve the form of the spatial metric here. So you can do these large gauge transformations which act non-linearly on zeta. Okay. And from a global symmetry perspective, they're exactly this dilation and this special conformal transformation. And you can see that they have a piece which is linear in the field, and they also have a piece which is independent of the field. So this is what I mean by non-linearly realized. Okay. Yes. So strictly speaking, the transformations that you need to do for these don't die at infinity. So there's the dilation is just a constant mode, it's constant at infinity. And then the special conformal transformation actually grows at infinity. Is that true? Okay. Okay, so just to reiterate, the symmetry breaking pattern here is that we're breaking the symmetries of the sitter down to the symmetries of a spatial slice, basically. Okay, I just want to make one side comment. So notice that dilations act non-linearly on zeta, but if zeta happens to have a shift symmetry, which you can imagine is sort of inherited from a shift symmetry of the potential for the scalar field, the linear combination of a dilation and this shift is actually linearly realized on zeta. And then you can go through the same manipulation that I told you in the exact de Sitter case to see that this guy must annihilate the two-point function, which tells you that the two-point function has to scale like 1 over k cubed. So you can really think of the scale invariance here as being, or you can think of flat potentials leading to scale invariance sort of in this language. So a flat potential gives you a approximate shift symmetry, and this approximate shift symmetry combined with the dilation tells you that you have to be very close to being scale invariant. Excuse me. Yes. Zeta does have a shift symmetry. Yes. So here I just want delta S to just be a shift of zeta. What breaks down here? Yeah, so I'll show you this in a minute. Roughly speaking, so if you have just delta D acting on this guy, you'll pick up some NS minus 1 type factor or something like this.
So you have the assumption fail here if you don't have exact scale invariance.
So if you can imagine, so you can go through this whole procedure for a theory which is very far from de Sitter, right? Just some FRW background, right? It will nonetheless, the action you get will be invariant under this symmetry, but it will not be invariant under just a pure shift of zeta. So
you think the action is not going to be invariant or something else? The action is always invariant under
shift. I don't think that's true. So the quadratic action, I completely agree, it's true, will always be, but higher point actions will not, I don't think. Does that make sense? Yeah, so it's obvious that the quadratic action will have to be because, so I claim that the full action will always be invariant under this transformation, and the quadratic action, when I do the nonlinear part, will have pieces linear and zeta, and there's nothing that can ever hope to cancel that off. So the quadratic action has to be invariant under the nonlinear piece by itself. But the higher point actions, precisely because this symmetry mixes different powers of zeta, there has to be cancellation between terms of different numbers of zeta in the action. So concretely, the three-point action will not be invariant under just this guy if you're far from de Sitter. Okay. So now I want to sort of answer your question in a different way, though, because you were asking what happens if you don't assume that you have this exact shift symmetry. What happens, right? So what happens is that the dilation acting on these correlation functions still contains some information. So it relates you to higher point functions, basically. Okay. So the name of these things are consistency relations. So the nonlinearly realized symmetries at play. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there you don't have a shift symmetry, so things will be broken. So you'll have some slight departure from scale invariance, which is basically set by these slow roll parameters. Or if you like, you can try to run through the same argument where you have sort of a approximate shift symmetry, but not a quite exact shift symmetry. Yeah, exactly. That's precisely true. So you know that inflation, the two-point function basically goes like 1 over k cubed plus epsilon, suitably understood, right? Okay, so... yeah, okay. So what I wanted to say is that the nonlinearly realized symmetries I told you about, so this dilation and these special conformal transformations, constrain correlation functions in the limit where you take one of the zeta legs to be soft, basically. Okay. So these things were originally derived using these so-called background wave arguments. So the idea is that you say the presence of a very long zeta mode is equivalent to a rescaling of coordinates, and from that you can infer that computing an endpoint function in the presence of a long mode is equivalent to computing an endpoint function in dilated coordinates. And then through some manipulations that I'll show you later, you can derive these relations. But these things have actually been derived in many different ways now. So you can see them using just field theoretic machinery. You can see it from the path integral. You can see it from the wave function of the universe type perspective. And they all agree on the results. So the most famous of these Ward identities goes under the name Maldacena's consistency relation, and it relates the three-point function to the power spectrum. So the statement is that the three-point function in the limit where one of the external legs has a very small momentum is related to ns minus 1, so the deviation from scale invariance times two products of the two-point function. So here, ns minus 1, there's really an epsilon hidden in here. Okay. So this is a consequence of the nonlinearly realized dilation symmetry. Okay, so this can be extended to endpoint functions sort of in the straightforward way. So this is the dilation operator. So an endpoint function with a soft external leg is related to the dilation operator acting on a lower point function. So this precisely captures the deviation from scale invariance of these correlation functions. And I should stress that this is actually true no matter how far away you are from De Sitter. So this is just true in any FRW space. Okay, so this is a powerful observational probe because the only assumptions that have gone into deriving relations of this type are that we have a single degree of freedom and then some technical things like you have Bunch Davies initial conditions and that the zeta goes to a constant far outside the horizon. So since so few assumptions went into this, a measurement of violation of this relation would rule out a wide class of models. In particular, it would rule out all single field models. Yeah, okay, so that, yeah, I should qualify this. Yeah, so what they say is that this whole thing is computed in co-moving coordinates. So if you then go to physical coordinates, you find that, in fact, the right-hand side vanishes, right? So you undo the coordinate transformation on the right-hand side. So really what this thing predicts is that a single observer should just see zero at the time that these things happened. So at the time of inflation, a co-moving observer should just see, or a physical observer should see nothing. But there can be effects where different patches come into the universe at different times, right? And you can compute what this effect is. Sorry, maybe I should just say it a different way. So it is true that a physical observer should see the right-hand side vanishes, but that's still a null test of inflation. So there are predictions of like what the background level of non-Gaussianity should be if you have zero primordial non-Gaussianity, so you can still have some sharp test, right? So it's still a relation that can be violated. Maybe that's the best way of saying it. Yeah, so one way to understand the argument that they're making is that, so everything I've derived for you, I've talked about global symmetries and talked about the gauge fixed action and things like this. But the point they want to make is that secretly this is all inherited from diff invariance, so you know that nothing really can depend in physical coordinates on diff invariance. You can't get any new information from it. Okay. So a reasonable question to ask, so here we've just taken one external leg to be soft, so a reasonable question to ask is what happens if you take more legs to be soft? And this is sort of inspired by what happens in the chiral Lagrangian. So for pions, if you take one soft leg, nothing really interesting happens. This is this famous Adler zero. You just find that the correlation function vanishes if you take any of the external momenta to be soft. But if you take two momenta to be soft, something very interesting happens. So since pions rely on some non-abelian structure, it matters the ordering in which you take these two things soft, and this parameterizes some path through the group space. And you find that taking two legs soft, on the right-hand side, what you get is sort of a momentum-dependent transformation on the remaining hard modes. Right? So a reasonable question to ask is, can we get some cool result like this for inflation? So the point is, taking more legs soft give you more null tests of inflation. Okay. So what should we expect? So diagrammatically, you imagine that there are sort of two ways that you can take two legs to be soft. You can either have them combine and have sort of a soft internal line with two soft external lines, or you can have just two soft external guys connecting to one vertex. So in this situation, what you expect to get is a three-point function, which is untransformed, and then a remaining point function, which is transformed by the presence of this long mode. And then here, you sort of expect there to be two transformations on the remaining hard modes. So remember that the analog is for a single soft leg. So if you ignore this, basically what happens is that this soft mode rescales all the remaining hard modes. And indeed, this is exactly what happens. Yeah. Yes. Why do you say we're going to gauge them away?
Yeah.
that example is very gravity, it's not gravitating the gauges of the problem. Mm-hmm. Another effect here for QED, the global symmetry would have been a rigid gauge transfer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm a bit confused. I mean, these are consistency conditions. So the idea is that if these hold, then you believe the theory, but I mean, if you have something completely different, then you don't expect this to hold.
In some cases, there's no difference in the sense that there's no restriction in the fact that you show the symmetry. What about the symmetry of unbroken, which is the iso of the control?
Well, I think what you say is only true if you're gauging the thing. So here, the fact that we're working with the gauge fixed action is really what's going on. So in the gauge fixed action, you can interpret this as some global symmetry breaking, and there you really expect there to be some physical consequences. Yes. Yeah. But okay. So in the gauge theory case, I can always go to some high energy limit. So let's take like a massive vector, for example, right? So if I go to the high energy limit, the scalar and the vector will decouple, and the scalar will still have some shift symmetry in this limit, and this is still a physical symmetry. So there'll be a Ward identity associated to this and things like that.
No, but I think the difference is that also in the gauge theory, you'll have other diagrams. So the essential point of those diagrams is you can take some of the external lines to be very small.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're in the gauge theory, you have other sub-diagrams which, those are the transverse modes are also very small. There are no other diagrams in this case.
Yeah, we could talk about it afterward. But I think the key point is that, so this theory admits basically a decoupling limit where you can decouple gravity in this scalar sector. And in this decoupling limit, these things are really physical global symmetries. So you have just an action for a scalar field living on De Sitter, which is invariant under these global symmetries. And so there I would expect there to be physical consequences.
So that's
yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand. Let's talk about it afterwards. Yeah, sorry. I mean, it seems like it's something worth understanding, though, so we should come back to it. Okay. So the point I want to make is that these sort of diagrammatic arguments end up being true. So you, looking just at dilations for concreteness, you end up finding that an n-point correlator with two soft legs, or I guess this is an n plus 2-point correlator with two soft legs, ends up having two types of contributions. One which is like a 3-point function of all soft momenta, and then a dilation acting on the remaining hard modes, and then one which is just two dilations acting on the remaining hard modes with suitable factors of power spectra to make everything work. So this offers many more consistency checks. So in principle, if we could go out and measure any endpoint function we like, there would be all these intricate web of relations between all of them, and you should really hope that maybe you could disentangle what precisely the symmetries were in the early universe. Okay, so now I want to switch gears a little bit. So we talked about inflation and symmetries there. So I want to discuss a little bit about alternatives to inflation. Okay, so inflation is very symmetric, it's very beautiful, but it's always worthwhile to have alternative theories. It's just good science. And inflation does have these fundamental puzzles that no one precisely knows how to address. Okay, so one takeaway message from the first part of the talk is that the symmetries of De Sitter are very powerful. They get you basically the scale invariant spectrum for free. So a natural question if you're searching for alternatives is, can we have sort of an effective De Sitter space? So can we have degrees of freedom think they live in De Sitter space but have the true geometry be very far from De Sitter? Okay, so it turns out that if you just have a single field, so if you just have a scalar field coupled to gravity, inflation is really the only way to do this. So if you can cook up an effective De Sitter by having either a very rapidly varying equation of state or a rapidly varying sound speed, you find that these theories always very quickly become strongly coupled. So inflation is really the unique weakly coupled way to have a De Sitter space with a single field. And so what this motivates us to do is to sort of consider multiple fields because we don't want to give up. We want to keep trying. So this leads us to this conformal scenario, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about. So this conformal scenario is also very deeply rooted in symmetry. So here, I'm actually talking about a different type of conformal symmetry. So before we were talking about conformal symmetry of a three slice, so here I want to have full 4D conformal symmetry. So here, what we're going to do is spontaneously break 4D conformal symmetry down to the symmetries of De Sitter. So here, the symmetries of De Sitter will be the residual symmetry after the global symmetry breaking. And the way that this happens concretely is that you imagine you have some conformal field theory, and then a field in the theory gets a VEV, which depends on time. And then we'll see that spectator fields in the theory couple to an effective De Sitter measure. Okay. And the point is that at early times, the universe is going to be described by a nearly conformal field theory on nearly flat space. And the geometry will evolve very slowly. Okay, and this will drive the background to be homogeneous. Okay, so another key point is that, so in inflation, you have De Sitter symmetry kicking around, but here we have full conformal invariance. So there'll be additional non-linearly realized symmetries. So there are correlation functions in the theory are more constrained than correlations in inflation. Okay, so let me give you the simplest example, and then we can talk in a little bit more generality. So let's think about just phi to the fourth theory with wrong sign potential. So this theory is classically conformally invariant. So it transforms under the conformal group like this. Okay, and I also want to consider coupling a weight zero field in the theory. So this phi field is a weight one field, as mass dimension one. Chi is a weight zero field. So the only way I can couple them to make the dimensions work out is that I have to have this extra factor of phi squared. And the key point is that you can think of this coupling between phi and chi as chi coupling to an effective metric, which depends on phi. Okay, so this thing admits a solution where phi goes like 1 over t. And the solution is an attractor. And here, time runs from minus infinity to 0.
But there's actually a tunneling solution.
Yeah, so you have to make sure that rolling is actually more advantageous than tunneling. So I haven't looked at this in detail, but people have looked at similar things in these like ekpyrotic type scenarios where you have exponential potentials. And there, you'd imagine the situation is even worse because you have an exponential potential. And there, I think people have convinced themselves that rolling is better than tunneling, that the rate is suppressed enough. So I think probably this is still true here. But if you like, this is just a toy example for now.
Eric Weinberg has been on this theory in
the 80s. He's looked at this particular one?
Yeah, the inverted number. Mm-hmm. There is a tunneling solution. You can work out what point you have a transition from tunneling to rolling.
I see. But there is some regime where rolling is better. OK, yeah. So for now, I'll just say, okay, I care about the regime where rolling is better, and my thing will get cut off at some point where tunneling becomes better, but I'm not going to worry about it for now. Okay, so the point is that in this spontaneously broken phase, chi couples to an effective metric which looks just like De Sitter. So here, this time coordinate just plays the role of De Sitter conformal time for in the perspective of the chi field. Okay, so if I take this action and I plug in this profile for phi, the chi field feels like a massless field on De Sitter, so it's not going to be super surprising that it gets a scale invariant spectrum. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the background cosmology, and then we'll go back to some more generalities about the general mechanism. Okay, so we've seen that, or at least we believe that it's likely that you can get a scale invariant spectrum, but we also need to solve the background cosmological puzzles. So I'm going to imagine coupling the CFT minimally to gravity in Einstein frame. So this, of course, breaks conformal invariance, but only at the 1 over m Planck level, which I'm OK with. So the dilation symmetry tells us that the energy density has to be 0 because it's conserved at lowest order. And then, I should say it again. So dilation symmetry tells us that rho and p can only depend on t. So by dimensional analysis, they have to go like 1 over t to the fourth. We know that at lowest order, rho is conserved, so it tells us that rho has to be 0. And then p scales like 1 over t to the fourth with some number here, which is a model-dependent number. Okay. So we can integrate the Friedman equation. We find that this is the Hubble parameter. And then you can compute what the equation of state parameter is. And it scales like t squared. Remember that t runs from minus infinity to 0. So this w is gigantic and decreasing towards 0. And this is very, very large. And remember that this corresponds to a very slowly contracting universe, right? And as I argued for you, this will drive the background to be homogeneous and isotropic. Yeah?
Wouldn't you get a conformal equation of state
Yeah, but I've broken conformal invariance at the 1 over m Planck level. Is that?
No.
No. Well, for, I mean, for a CFT, I'd expect trace of t to be 0, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but here, so this CFT, it's not, so maybe CFT is the wrong way to, it's really it's spontaneously broken. It has no conformally invariant vacuum. Yeah, I think.
Any configuration of the magnetic field pressure is not there that there's a field. So, well, it's a pressure. Okay. Even if the configuration is not some problem. It's because there's a random that's your stress. But the breaking is one of our.
Oh, well, I mean, the CFT itself, though, doesn't have a conformally invariant vacuum. It only has, it only exists in a broken phase. It is just true, though. So this theory is classically conformally invariant. You can compute its T mu nu, and you find out that this is true. I mean, I don't know. We could talk about it afterwards. I'm a bit confused. Okay. Yeah, so here, the point I want to make is that generically you expect W to be very, very large, and this will drive the background to be homogeneous. Okay, so we've been talking about symmetries this whole time, so let me tell you a little bit about what the symmetries are in this situation. So the action I started with is SO42 invariant, and then it admits the solution where phi scales like 1 over t. And of course, this profile breaks some of the symmetries, so it breaks time translations, it breaks boosts, and it breaks basically the zero component of special conformal transformations. So there are some remaining residual symmetries, spatial translations, spatial rotations, and the Ki conformal transformations. And these can all be, and these can all be repackaged into the de Sitter algebra SO41. And this sort of makes it obvious that de Sitter space was kicking around in our phi to the fourth example, right? So it's not surprising that we could write it in a manifestly SO41 symmetric way. And the point I want to argue for you is that most of the relevant physics actually follows solely from this symmetry breaking pattern, right? That it's independent of this particular phi to the fourth realization that I've told you about. Okay, so indeed there are many realizations of this type of thinking. So you can have a negative quartic potential, or you can allow it to be a complex scalar and sort of have this negative U1 invariant thing. And there, this chi field that I wanted to couple in really is just the phase of this complex field, so you sort of get it for free. There's this Galilean genesis. So this is a higher derivative scalar field which nonlinearly realizes conformal symmetry. And then this also admits a 1 over t solution with the same symmetry breaking pattern. You find that you can couple fields in an appropriate way for them to see an effective de Sitter metric. And actually, so this Galilean genesis scenario violates the null energy condition, which we'll come back to in a little bit. And then you can also exploit the isomorphism between the isometries of anti-de Sitter space and the conformal group in one dimension lower. And you can imagine having a brain probing an anti-de Sitter space, nonlinearly realizing conformal symmetry. And indeed, if you look at just the world volume action for a flat brain in ADS, you find that it admits a solution which goes like 1 over t and has the right symmetry breaking pattern. And you can couple fields in an appropriate way. OK, so I've argued for you that the things I want to say are basically independent of particular realizations. So I want to co-opt some particle physics technology and construct the most general low energy effective action for this symmetry breaking. And the way to do this is this coset construction. So there is this subtlety that we've touched on before. So here we've broken five symmetries, but we actually only need one Goldstone mode to realize all these symmetries. OK, so I'll just sketch the technique. So basically, you just parameterize the group coset. So here it's SO42 over SO41. The building block is this geometric object that lives on the group coset, this Mara Kartan form. You can expand it in the basis of the generators, and then by wedging together or building covariant derivatives out of these dudes, you can build actions which linearly realize the subgroup you're interested in and also nonlinearly realize the broken group. So here are some details which are ugly. So it ends up being that the two derivative action for the symmetry breaking pattern we're interested in is given by this expression. And so you can expand this guy out to quadratic order, and you find that the Goldstone mode looks like a scalar field living on De Sitter with a negative mass. This negative mass is not worrisome, though, because the theory has this time shift, which you can use to absorb the growing mode. And you can compute the two-point function for this guy, so it has a negative mass. It's not surprising that it's super red. And we can also couple spectator fields using this technology. So basically, the idea is you want to couple this guy to pi, and this guy nonlinearly realizes the additional symmetries you're interested in. So this is the lowest order action coupling chi to this pi field. And the point I want to make is that this pi chi chi coupling is forced upon you by symmetry. So this guy, this is a model-dependent parameter, so that can be either zero or not. But this is just forced on you by the symmetries of the theory. Okay, and then this spectator field, if this thing is small, which you can enforce with a shift symmetry if you like. So in the U1 case, it's very natural. Then the field acquires a scale invariant spectrum. Okay. We want to see what the effects of these nonlinearly realized symmetries are on correlation functions in the theory. So the correlation functions are invariant under linearly realized De Sitter symmetries, but they also have these additional nonlinearly realized symmetries. And these, exactly in the way that they did in inflation, constrain correlation functions with different numbers of fields. So the broken symmetries act nonlinearly on pi in this way. So the only one that we need to focus on for now is that a translation has a nonlinear piece that goes like 1 over t. And we'll derive these through a background wave argument, but you can also derive them through word identities. So let's imagine doing a time translation. So as I argued, this induces a pi mode that goes like 1 over t. So let's start with a correlation function with n fields, and I want to compute it in the background of a long pi mode. So this is equivalent to computing the endpoint function, but in transformed time coordinates, just doing a constant time translation. So I can Taylor expand the right-hand side up to first order, so I get c times the endpoint function. But then I want to match the fact that this guy, so I want to use this to match that c is equal to minus t times pi long. So I plug that in there, I multiply by pi long and average over both sides, and I find that this relation is true. So if I have an endpoint function with a soft external Goldstone, on the right-hand side, what I would get is basically just the time derivative acting on the remaining guys. Okay, so I showed you how this works for just the broken time translations. There are also word identities for the broken boosts and the broken special conformal transformations. They can be derived in an analogous way. And you find that this is the consistency relation. And notice that, so in inflation, we're only able to constrain things up to order q. But here, since we have additional symmetries, we're actually able to constrain things up to order q squared. So this is basically a vestige of the broken special conformal transformations. Okay, so it turns out that since pi is very soft, it's sort of questionable whether or not you can observe such a long wavelength external mode. But what is true is that pi is very red, so it will be the dominant contribution to endpoint functions that exchange a soft internal line. And so you can get model-independent statements by examining soft internal lines of the Goldstone. So it'll be the dominant contribution to these diagram factorizations. So the point is, if you have an m plus endpoint function that exchanges soft internal line, you can factorize it into an endpoint function plus an endpoint function, where these that are sort of soft limits of pi, right? So the idea is you can think of it as the product of this guy with a soft external line and this guy with another soft external line. And then we can use the consistency relations that we just derived to say something about the correlation function in this limit. Okay, so there are two distinct contributions to the four-point function. One comes from a tree-level type diagram, and it has this shape. And so if you think of a very long wavelength pi mode, you can think of it as it will lead to realization-dependent anisotropy in the power spectrum. So the point is, when pi becomes soft enough, it becomes more profitable to think of this four-point function as a variance of the two-point function than really think of it as a true four-point function. And then there's also a contribution which comes from exchanging a loop of pi's. And this thing is basically of tau NL type shape. And that means that it can lead to these things like CMB, mu distortions, or stochastic scale-dependent bias. But it's a little bit difficult to understand how big the effect will be because it depends upon this model-dependent cutoff in this logarithm. Okay, but you can take existing constraints on tau NL and deduce some bound on the parameters in the theory. And it ends up not being so enlightening because it just tells you that the two-point function has to be less than one, basically.
How does the mesh work in the
this one? This one, sorry. Probably this should be added too, sorry. I see, because you're saying you're asking about the effective field theory expansion?
Yeah,
so there are sort of two scales in the problem. So there's some scale at which the symmetry breaking occurs, right? And this is the scale that will suppress higher derivative operators. And then there's also this Hubble scale, which is sort of like some IR cutoff, if you like. So it's similar to inflation. No, in inflation, things aren't suppressed by Hubble, right? So if you take the effective field theory of inflation viewpoint, there's some scale above which you don't know what happens, and something happens to cause you to inflate. I think there you expect higher dimensional operators to be suppressed by just the Planck scale, right? Okay, so in the last couple minutes, let me just say something about the null energy condition. So one thing that any alternative to inflation has to do at some point is to violate the null energy condition. So we know that we currently live in an expanding universe, but most of these alternatives either rely on a phase of contraction or they rely on violating the null energy condition themselves, like in Galilean genesis. So at some point, you want to transit from contraction to expansion, and the Friedmann equation tells us that in order to have h dot bigger than zero, you have to violate the null energy condition. So the null energy condition in terms of a perfect fluid, just tells you that rho plus p has to be non-negative.
You're assuming you're in effectively four-dimensional geometry.
Yes. Yeah. So minimally coupled. I haven't done anything crazy.
Are exotic things you could consider?
Yeah. So, what do you mean, sorry?
Well, you would consider, you might say that there's a regime of quantum gravity, which is important. There are.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I want to do classical GR. I don't want to do.
You were just overstating these a little. So I just
oh, okay. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, okay, so for sure there can be crazy quantum gravitational effects that I don't know anything about, but I want to do just classical, yeah. Okay, sorry. Okay, all right, so in the context in which I'm working, if I want to have h dot bigger than zero, you have to violate the neck. Okay, so this is an open question whether or not this is possible with a sensible theory. So most of the examples that we have exhibit pathologies, so either the theory also admits superluminality or it has ghosts or it has gradient instabilities or any bunch of million things that can go wrong. So let me give you two examples where things go wrong. So one is just a canonical scalar field. So in this theory, rho plus p is basically just proportional to the kinetic term. So if I want this to be negative, so I'm using mostly plus signature. So if I want this to be negative, I need to choose a wrong sign kinetic term. And this tells me that, so neck violation comes hand in hand with ghosts in this example. So a more non-trivial example is I can take a p of x theory. So here, the action is just some polynomial in the kinetic term, basically. And here, the neck is proportional to, rho plus p is proportional to p comma x. But then if I expand the theory around some time-dependent background, I find that the gradient term here is also proportional to p comma x. So if I want to make this guy negative, I necessarily have this guy have wrong sign. So neck violation here comes hand in hand with gradient instability. What's that?
Unless you're happy
of having good. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry. So this is the simplest example, but yeah, so. Yeah, then you have a ghost. Yeah, yeah, okay, perfect. Yeah, so there's this general theorem by these guys that if you have a Lagrangian which depends only on phi and d phi, you're basically guaranteed to have superluminal propagation, ghosts, or gradient instabilities if you violate the neck. And depending upon how you choose to do this, you can pick which instability you want to have. Okay. But already this sort of indicates a way out. So this depends on some effective field theory reasoning. So you imagine that only phi and d phi are important. So you say, okay, well, maybe I can cook up a regime where d squared phi is important. So notice that this will necessarily require some reorganization of effective field theory, right? Because you're wanting higher terms in the derivative expansion to become important. So there are two examples where this can actually happen. So one is the ghost condensate. And here the point is that p comma x actually exactly vanishes at the ghost condensate point. So higher order spatial gradient terms can become important without the derivative expansion breaking down. Another one is Galilean genesis. So the Galileans are these higher derivative scalar fields. And they're set up in such a way that box phi can actually become quite large while still keeping the effective theory under control. So this guy admits a solution that goes like 1 over t, where rho plus p is negative. So it violates the null energy condition. So there is a problem with this theory. So it has superluminality about small deformations around this solution. So maybe you don't think this is good. And both of these theories have one major drawback, which is that neither of them have a Poincaré invariant vacuum. So really what we would like is to have a theory which starts out in a Poincaré invariant vacuum and then can transition into some phase which violates the null energy condition. This is like, I think our own theoretical bias that the theory should be definable in terms of some Poincaré invariant background. Also, if you want to, so I would like the theory to also be applicable sort of now, right? So if you imagine that this is operating in the early universe, you say, okay, at some point you. No, but I think people, just as a problem in and of itself, would like to have a theory which is definable about a Poincaré invariant vacuum that also admits a neck violating solution. It's sort of an interesting question to ask whether or not it's possible, just as a zeroth order thing. Okay, so this actually can be fixed. You can cook up a theory which both has a neck violating solution and a Poincaré invariant background, but the price you pay is that you have to consider a slightly more complicated theory. So here, we're gonna go back to this theory of a brain probing an ADS space, and so the induced metric on the brain is this guy, and we're gonna consider the theory of curvature invariance, so Gauss-Bonnet terms and boundary terms for these Gauss-Bonnet terms. And the point of doing this is that these things are guaranteed to have second order equations of motion for this field phi, so it'd have a well-defined Cauchy problem and things like that. And then the goal is to choose the coefficients of these five operators so that the theory has nice properties. Okay, so here's a chart of how we can do it. Oh, so this came out purple, it should be red, I guess. But so the point is that we're able to choose the coefficients so that the theory both has a Poincaré invariant background and a neck violating background. And furthermore, that around the Poincaré invariant background, the theory is actually subluminal. So there is no superluminality about the Poincaré invariant background. So there is one bad thing that remains, and it's that, so about deformations of the Poincaré invariant background, the theory still admits superluminality, right? So you can't quite banish all the superluminality from the theory, but you do slightly better than these other examples. Okay, and one outstanding question is whether or not theories of this type can be consistent with black hole thermodynamics. So it's known, for example, that the ghost condensate, you can violate the second law of thermodynamics, basically, from throwing ghost condensate particles into a black hole. I should have referenced it. So it's Dubovsky and Sibiryakov, maybe? Sorry, what? Oh, yeah, sorry. So one is subluminality about the neck violating background. So the Galilean genesis fails this. So slight deformations around the neck violating background admit superluminal propagation. And then the other one is, once we have a Poincaré invariant background, you could imagine taking some weak field deformation of this guy, and you also want perturbations around that guy to be subluminal, right? And that's what this theory fails. So it slight deformation. So of course, the Poincaré invariant solution, everything is exactly luminal, but slight deformations away from it, you can induce a background where you can have superluminal propagation of signal. Yeah, so you can break the conformal invariance of the Galilean in order to have a subluminal solution around the neck violating background. But this doesn't let you have a Poincaré invariant background, nonetheless. Okay, so here, I think I'm gone over time, so I'll just leave up my conclusions. I guess I want to say one thing is that the different symmetries I've talked about should show up in correlation functions. So in principle, there are sharp observational tests distinguishing these theories. Okay, thank you. Oh, it's just because these theories don't have a Poincaré invariant background. So I wanted to be kind and not put a bunch of X's, so I figured I'd just shade it out. Okay, cool. Thanks.